News time now, 8:14. Well, as we've reported, Summit County's Fair Director Travis English is moving on. He joins us now on the phone for a look back at some of the improvements that were made during his tenure, as well as a look ahead at what's next to him. Good morning, Travis.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me, Leslie?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Well, so how many years on the job here?
You know, so I was at Summit County. I was originally hired as a private contractor to take over the fair and rodeo. So that was for 2 years. And then 4 years, I was a full-time employee for the county. So 6 years total.
Yeah. And it wasn't just the fair and rodeo you're responsible. You was actually, I think, more of a special events manager.
Exactly. So the special events manager for the county, I was in charge of handling all the film permitting throughout the county. There's a lot of film projects that have been happening, as well as any large event. So if it was over 5,000 people, so from Tour of Utah to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation event that's happening at Canyons this weekend, I was involved with the permitting. And, yeah, it was great. I also did the public art board. I was the liaison to the public art board as well.
Yeah, well, I think you were pretty instrumental in staging the Big Boy Whistle Stop and Echo celebration as well.
Absolutely. That was a lot of fun. It was part of the celebration for Spike 150. And, yeah, it was a great event. Several thousand people. I think you were there, actually. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. So I helped organize that with Anita Lewis as well.
Yeah. So in terms of the changes that we've seen at the fairgrounds, I mean, talk a little bit about the changes that you and the fair board brought in terms of the infrastructure improvements.
Yeah. So the changes itself, whenever I took the fair over about 6 years ago, things were kind of running south. The events themselves weren't really selling out. So the number one thing that I was brought on to do was bring more people to the fair and the event itself. We were successful in that endeavor. And then afterwards, the county council 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, elected to put $5 million worth of improvements into the Summit County Fairgrounds. So the Legis Event Center is a beautiful new facility there that can host large events. They put four new livestock barns in there and just kind of redid the look and feel of the fairgrounds itself. And I know this year, after the fair this year, they're going to put $300,000 into like pathways, walkways, and improve connectivity on the grounds itself.
Yeah. And in terms of programming changes, I mean, what did you do there?
Yes, yeah, so we added all sorts of things. The one of the fun events that we added was the Sunrise Rotary. It's called the Tour to Sunrise, and that happens Saturday morning of the fair, kind of the big day of the fair, and that's a bike ride. We added different elements. We've changed up the live music, really turned to local-based musicians, added a beer, wine, and spirits garden. That was a big deal a couple years ago when we did that, and it was successful. So, yeah, just kind of little changes throughout the event to make it more complete. And really, one of the things that people would come to the fair itself, they would – so there wasn't a whole lot going on when I got there. So our goal was to activate the event throughout the week. So when people got there, there was a lot happening. And there was no carnival midway before I got there. So now there's rides and, you know, the Ferris wheel, kind of the traditional county fair you may picture from your childhood.
Yeah. How successful do you think you've been, though, in making the fair appealing to residents here on the west side? We know it was always a good showing from the folks on the east side.
You know, it was great. We added buses from the Park City Transit Center down in Kimball Junction, and we had over 400 people take it last year. We wanted to make it feel easy for people to get out there, that you could hop on any bus within the Park City, Summit County bus, district, I guess, and head out to the fairgrounds and not have to drive. So it was great. We had people from all over Park City. We advertised it, because it's paid out of the TRT tax, we advertised the local hotels, and we'd have, you know, concierges calling and saying, I've got four kids that want to come ride a sheep today. So it was successful, too, not only within residents here as visitors to the county as well.
Yeah. So in retrospect, I mean, what did you think about the idea when the county considered moving the fair site to Hoytsville? I know it didn't work out and it was returned to Colville Park, but it required some land purchase.
Yes, it did. And, you know, that the fair has been happening in that specific spot for over 100 years. It's it's a beautiful fairgrounds. I know you've been there, in that there's cottonwood trees that wrap around the river, and there's a beautiful pathway. And I was excited to see it, you know, stay in Colville and kind of its historic home. It's one of the number one things the cowboys that come from all over the West, they love the small town feel of that grounds, and how it's up against the river. It gets cool at night there, and it's a beautiful location. So I thought it was great.
Yeah, stayed where it is. The fair now just a month away. The county has announced that it's hired Tyler Orgill to replace you, at least on a seasonal basis. Have you left him in a lurch, or did you leave him a well-oiled machine here?
That's funny that you say that. I told him the other day, I talked to him, and he said, you set me up for success. So I had known that I was approached by another company to work there, and I'd known that, you know, I was in the process of transitioning to a new role elsewhere. And knowing that, I kind of busted my butt to get things organized and ready for him. And he was my intern for the past 3 years. So he's no stranger to the fair, and it's working. So I'm sure he'll do a great job. And he's a smart kid, and I'm really excited for him. I think he'll do an awesome job.
Okay. So what are your plans now? Do you stay in town?
Yep, staying in town, but working just down in the Salt Lake Valley for the Western Electricity Coordinating Council in Salt Lake. So yesterday was day one. I'm actually en route there right now.
Okay, let's get back to the driving. Hey, good
luck. Awesome.
Thanks for the great days at the fair, Travis, and we'll see you around town.
All right, take care, Leslie. Thank you.
8:28 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. The Park City Council meets Thursday to discuss an environmental summit, an update on the Arts and Culture District, and the Kimball Arts Festival. Joining us with a preview, I have City Manager Diane Foster, Economic Development Manager Jonathan Weidenhammer, and Luke Curtin, our Sustainability Manager. Good morning.
Good morning.
Luke, let's start with you. The city's set to host a number of Mountain Town communities in this fall to discuss climate goals and strategies for achieving them at the Mountain Towns 2030 Summit. So can you tell us a little bit about what towns will be represented and why this is a beneficial format for this conversation?
Yeah, great question. So one of the great successes we've been able to show is collaboration with other mountain communities. You can use our 100% renewable bill that we just passed to the collaboration between Park City, Salt Lake City, Summit County, Moab. Now Cottonwood Heights is joining us as well. And having that centralized goal, I believe, was very key to having negotiations with the utility. It wasn't just Park City trying to make this lift. It was a multitude of communities. And same thing with the legislature as well. We could use our different strengths and our different contacts to help the bill pass. The other thing, outside of the state, we have regular contacts with a great example is like the city and county of Missoula, the two governments there. They actually just set a 100% renewable bill, and they're really interested about our renewable legislation we passed. We're talking to Boise about their zero waste programs and that side of it. So we have this informal group, and the thought was if we got about 40 mountain communities together, and we're using the term mountain fairly broadly, we're talking the larger ones from Salt Lake City, Boise, that side, and some of the smaller ones too, like some of the small, like Tellurides and that side of it. So the goal is to get everyone in the same room and say, hey, if we all looked at setting ambitious climate goals on the 2030 timeline and really truly kind of stepped it up in the best practice sharing and the latest kind of science and the latest, you know, there's pieces that every community holds that's key that they're a subject matter expert in. We really think that this kind of greater sharing and marching towards a greater goal is going to be effective. You know, we get asked on a monthly basis, hey, could you sign on to this letter or that letter? But a lot of them don't have goals. They don't have, you know, ambitious timelines. You know, a 2050 goal, it doesn't feel ambitious. So our hope is to pull these communities together. The great thing is talking to these communities initially, both electeds and municipal governments, there is support there. And we've also been talking to supporting resort industries, the ski industry, the, you know, hotel industry, some of the snow sports industry of America members, and they're all very supportive as well. So the great thing is that this has been kind of floating around out there, and the goal is to really use it to hopefully drive some action and get everyone marching towards the same goal.
Yeah, so how many people do you expect at the conference?
About 250, and that's a mix of municipal governments, some industry folks, some NGOs are going to be another key piece, the community foundations helping talk to other community foundations. We're talking to other land trusts as well. Key businesses in these communities as well. And the thought is, you know, a city government can't nor should do this alone. So the thought is, let's broaden the tent and get everyone together. So the main themes are, the first day is kind of inspiration. Second day is the problem solving solutions piece. And the third day is getting out and about and seeing some of the solutions that are in place in Park City.
So is this kind of an invite only, or?
It's a lot of it's going to be, it's very targeted towards these groups. So it'll be fairly technical. We'll have some seats set aside for the public. The big pieces, the kind of the headline parts are, the evening of the first night, October 2nd, we're actually going to have Jane Goodall, and that will be addressing not only the conference attendees, but we're going to invite the community into that as well. Jane is, you feel like a kindergartner again. She's amazing to hear talk, and actually her talks have focused on climate change and action towards it. The second day, the major headline there is Paul Hawken. He wrote Project Drawdown. He's got the Drawdown Fund. And the great thing is, when we reached out to both of them and their organizations, they stepped up immediately and said, yes, we want to be a support of it. So we have two major headlines. And then on top of that, we have a lot of best practices. We have a finance board that's talking about where sustainable finance is going, especially on municipal levels. We have a grassroots part, too, saying this is how your community, these are the major concerns of your community, and this is how the best way to engage and communicate with them.
Okay. Jane Goodall, I mean, she's a big ticket speaker. Who's paying?
She's exciting. So that's a great question. So the city, out of our budget, we're doing $30,000, and that's the logistics support. You know, I jokingly say I planned one wedding and that set me up really well for some of those conference pieces. So that's everything from, you know, Mike Reynolds, AV, and that side of it. The really interesting thing, Leslie, is the support we're having come in from various sponsors. Right now, committed in this community, cash in hand already, Snow Crews really stepped up, Rosignol, Ski Butlers, and we've got verbal commitments from some very recognizable businesses from the mountain community piece that will be rolling out here over the next few weeks. But the great thing is, this is, the support is really truly coming in, and even Paul Hawken is being sponsored by his own fund, the Drawdown Fund. It's about $150 million fund to really go after solutions of reversing the issue we fight.
Okay. Again, this is happening, what, October 2nd through the 4th?
Yep, 2, 3, and 4. Yep, right now we have a website up that's just a landing page. It's getting updated this week, mt2030.org. And we'll definitely be keeping folks informed through KPCW, through the park record, through the website, council updates, and all this other stuff. Because there are a lot of people who are interested in this, and there might be sections. If they're interested in attending, we'll make sure we save some seats.
Great. Okay. Diane, the city council will be receiving Thursday an update on the Arts and Culture District. Where are we at in this process?
Where we're at in this process is that the three organizations, you remember in the summer of 2017, Kimball Arts Center, Sundance Institute, and Park City Municipal signed an agreement to move forward on this, and a letter of intent. And so we've been moving forward. I know from a public perspective, we've been a little bit quiet. It's mainly because the design teams have been working in the background. So we're in the design and development phase, as well as working some on the programming and activation. So the three entities have been working on their program, what's actually going to happen in which building, and where does the city want to fill in if somebody doesn't have a particular discipline in theirs, and a lot of work with Lake Flato, who's the city's master plan architect. And so right now we're targeting to go to the Planning Commission with a master plan development in the fall.
All right. At what point do Kimball and Sundance commit?
They commit, I think it's pretty soon. I think it's around this winter. I don't know the exact date, but it's when they make the commitment to their property. Now, that being said, I would, my perspective is they're committed. I've been in lots of meetings, lots of board members, lots of staff time dedication to this, and it's exciting.
Yeah. We've heard both, you know, that both Kimball and Sundance planning their new headquarters. What we haven't heard about is the rest of the property. Do we have anything, ideas about what that's going to look like?
We do. And I think you'll hear Nate Rockwood talk about this. He's project manager on this. What the other is 60 to 90,000 square feet of other. We do know one of the things that Mayor Jack Thomas and the city council at the time and the current mayor and city council have committed to is meeting the code. So we've spent a lot of time on what buildings can we fit where, what makes sense, some of the elements. We need to meet the parking requirements, so there will be structured parking, but we anticipate that will be an art piece in and of itself. There'll be a food hall, not in the airport kind with Sparrow, but more in the form of things that you see like at Chelsea Market in New York, where you see vibrant local food providers coming in and having a space in there. And so the city's focus really is twofold. One is creating vibrancy in the district, right? We want that to be living and breathing. There'll be artist housing there as well as affordable housing. It'll be connected to the Homestake lot. It'll be connected to Main Street.
Is the Homestake housing being developed as part of this master plan, or is that all separate?
It's related, but not necessarily contingent upon one another. Timing-wise, they'll be quite similar in timing, and we do want them to have a connection with the Arts and Culture District. So we do expect that there'll probably be, well, there'll definitely be artist housing in the both short-term and more permanent in the district, and there may be some also in Homestake.
The city also looking to hire an arts and culture development manager to guide creative development in the district. So when does this person get hired on?
We're working with an individual. I don't think we're at the point where we'll be talking to city council over the next few weeks. We're not at the point to pull the trigger, but we're talking to an individual who's got significant experience in resort town arts and culture district development. And so bringing that person on specifically to help out with the phases of the programming and activation, as well as the operations and governance. Even though we're years away from, you know, it opening, we're already looking at how will it work, how will property leases be done, and we'll be partnering very much with both the private sector as well as with local arts organizations. The Park City Summit County Arts Council will be very involved in this as well.
Let's see. You just met with the town manager of Hideout as well as with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Staff is presenting a few dates for public meetings to discuss Park City's annexation policy plan. At the last meeting, council had instructed planning staff to pursue an expansive annexation expansion area plan, somewhat expedited by the actions of the Hideout Town Council. So they have their meeting set to before Planning Commission and then a vote by the Town Council scheduled for August 8th. Ours are much later. It sounds like there's some race going on, though, in terms of who names what areas first.
Sure. And unlike other situations, this is not one that matters who's in first. Two jurisdictions can have the same property in their annexation expansion plan, in their annexation policy plan, and in their annexation expansion area map. So that's likely to happen by both entities. Our staff will be moving quite quickly. And as a reminder for folks, the city's been looking at this property and been working with Summit County carefully on careful planning for decades. And the city council kind of first relooked at this property in April. We had no idea Hideout was even looking at it. They didn't notice us either as a property owner or as the jurisdiction within a half mile of the boundary, which both were required. So we've asked them, the city and the county formally asked Hideout to remand to start the process over because they'd missed a number of steps. And they agreed to do that. And so they're going back to their planning commission. We'll be moving quickly through the process, and it's quite likely that we'll both end up with the property in our annexation policy plans.
Yeah, but like I asked Planning Director Bruce Erickson, what then you arm wrestle for it? I mean, how is it decided then who gets what, even though it's in both plans? Because you both can't have it.
Right. It can't actually be. It can both be in both our plans. It can't be annexed by both of us. That's correct. What came out of our meeting this morning at a 7 a.m. meeting with the town manager, Dan McCosh, of Hideout, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, was our councils are, we're going to ask some representatives of our councils to get together, probably also along with Wasatch County, and we're looking at early August for that, and I'll be asking our council tomorrow night if we have two representatives who'd be willing to do that and just sit down and get to know each other. This morning, getting the history of Hideout, and I think some folks know that the incorporation law that allowed that to happen said if you own a property and the town has, and there are more than 100 people, you can incorporate a town. It's a tough situation for Hideout. They only have property tax, and they have one property owner owns 75% of the property within the city. And that's hard math to do. Their budget's under $1 million, and it's if you've only got one taxing source, and that's property tax, it's really hard to manage a budget. So I definitely feel for them, and I think the getting some councils together and starting to have some discussions would make sense.
Okay. I'm unable to pull up the agenda, Jonathan Weidenhammer, but the Kimball Arts Fest is coming out, and we'll certainly bring somebody on later to preview that, the event. But what the council, I think, is considering approving is a $161,000 fee reduction.
Well, quickly, every year we come back and have council approve any changes from last year's festival. So this is, again, August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And this is the 50th anniversary for Kimball, so we really want to celebrate that with them and what Kimball's bringing to the table this year, which is really different. And we're happy to bring is the Free the Fest for all locals. So it's free for all, Summit County residents. They have asked that you register in advance on their website, kimballartscenter.org. And then you come and pick up those wristbands in advance at the existing Kimball Center. And then probably the other big thing is that parking will be $5 an hour on Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 5, but normal rates on Friday.
Okay. So this $161,000, I mean, what does that support?
That's just all the stuff. It's transit and cops and, you know, all the operations and just barricades and just getting all the city services out there. So I think there's 4 more police officers this year than there have been in the past. And, you know, with all that money, the transit system and the public safety system, I find them to be really well coordinated, and they come off pretty well with Kimball's efforts.
Yeah. Do we offer similar reductions to the other festivals, Deer Valley Music Festival, Sundance, things like that?
I think they're fairly similar. You know, anytime you shut down a street in its entirety and all the operations that go with it, there tends to be a few more things that come with it. But, you know, Kimball's been a longstanding partner. It's one of the 4 groups that we have a longstanding city services agreement with that are negotiated through a long-term contract. And so, you know, Kimball can be a little bit different because it is different.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to say about that?
No, we're just excited to work with them on the Free the Fest and their 50th anniversary.
Okay. Let's see. Real quick, I wanted to mention that final day to give input on the State Route 248 plan is
tomorrow.
Midnight tonight. Oh, Thursday.
Thursday.
Yes.
Thursday. And in fact, on the agenda, we do have an item that we'll be looking for. The mayor's asked that we look at doing a city council resolution, and he's been talking with the deputy director of UDOT, and they'd like to formally know the city council's opinion on this. So we'll be getting direction from city council this Thursday on that. But it was very important to our city council that they not weigh in. They'll be weighing in a couple hours before, maybe an hour or two before the public process closes. But they've really waited and held off with even comments as individuals, just waiting and making sure the public has an opportunity. Again, we're in a different process than just doing a regular city street, and public input is really important. And if you just Google SR 248, it'll come up, and you can put your public comment in right online.
Okay. Hey, Diane, Luke, and Jonathan, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, Summit County has installed 12 new electric vehicle charging stations at various county facilities. In the studio with details, I have Summit County Sustainability Manager Lisa Yorder. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So is this 12 or is it 12 of more coming?
It's 12 so far,
yeah.
Added to a couple that we have at the Richens building already.
Okay. How many do you hope to have?
I don't have a specific number. This is part of Council's vision and strategic plan to create a network of charging stations in the county. These are essential to the county fleet. The county can't purchase electric vehicles and move forward unless we have charging stations. So these were put in place primarily for county fleet vehicles, first and foremost.
How many county fleet electric vehicles do you have?
At this point, we have 2, and we have some on order. And each year, as we turn over retiring gas vehicles, we switch to electric, where it's feasible and where it makes sense.
Okay. So who paid for the charging stations? County taxpayers or?
80% of the funds for these chargers were provided by grants from Rocky Mountain Power.
Okay. And then where did you decide to put them?
We put 2 in at the Camas Services Building in Camas. We put 2 in Colville, plus a fast charger in Colville to serve interstate traffic where they have to stop and charge quickly. And we put two in at the Public Health Department over in Round Valley. And these are all located where there are other employers in the area and where the public can also use those chargers as part of the overall transition to electric vehicles.
Okay. Right now, the county's picking up the electricity tab?
Yes, it's really pennies a day to charge a vehicle. And instead of buying fuel, we pay for the electricity.
Okay. Even for members of the public then?
Right. At this time, these are network chargers. They're smart chargers in that they're networked via and accessed via credit cards or apps. We don't charge at this time, but we could at any point in time change them to operate during certain hours where fleet vehicles have a priority or that instills a fee for the users. But we have found, and nationally it's known, that charging a fee disengages people from using the chargers, which defeats the purpose of installing them.
Okay. So you mentioned you had one fast charger. The rest of them are slow chargers?
Well, normal, let's say. Level 2 chargers, they're faster than your home outlet that people will have in their garage typically. So they would charge a battery, depending on how low it was depleted, in anywhere from 4 to 8 hours. So they're perfect for parking lots where people park all day at our facilities where staff and fleet vehicles are parked. They're perfect for the park and ride lot at Ecker Hill, where we installed 5. But the fast chargers charge in 20 to 30 minutes, depending on how depleted the battery is and the size of the battery. And that's why we've located fast chargers in Kimball Junction and Colville on the I-80 corridor.
Okay. Why not put all fast chargers? Are they that much more expensive?
Oh, yes. They're quite a bit more expensive. Yes. Level 2 charger is in the range of $5,000 for a smart charger, and the DC fast chargers are in the range of $25,000-$35,000.
Okay. So you do need to have an app on your smartphone in order to use these, so you can just plug in?
An app is required, yes, to use them.
Okay. So you know who's using them. Is that it?
We know the vehicle, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's necessary to track the data. So we can monitor the costs and determine at what point we might want to instill a fee. But as I said, particularly since these are the expense of installation has been covered by generous grants from Rocky Mountain Power, the whole goal is transition to clean vehicles that reduce tailpipe emissions and help keep our air clean. So council's forethought and planning is what got us here, where everyone benefits from the pennies we spend a day on electricity.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No. Thank you for having me come in.
Okay. Lisa Yoder is Summit County's Sustainability Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:50 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, back in May, Park City resident Laura Diaz Moore underwent major surgery to donate one of her kidneys. It wasn't for her child or a sibling. It was given to a complete stranger. She joins me now in the studio to tell us a little bit more about her story and her decision to help someone in need. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first, how are you doing? I'm, a couple months out of surgery?
Yeah, it's been 2 months, basically, and I'm feeling great, actually.
Yeah. Any regrets?
Not at all. It was such a positive experience. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. I received so much love and support from everyone in the community, and it was just a great experience.
Yeah, well, so tell us a little bit about this. I mean, again, like I say, I mean, it was just, you must have seen or heard something that said, oh, I can do this, I can help somebody.
You know, I've always been drawn to stories of organ donation. They just seem so intriguing to me. And then a couple months ago, well, actually it was in the fall, I came across a Facebook post that my sister had shared, and it was from a friend of a friend who had a 16-year-old who needed a kidney, and it was a plea from the mom asking for someone to donate a kidney, And it was just this desperate plea. It just struck me because I, at the time, I had a 16-year-old who's now 17, but it just struck me in a way I just could relate. So I decided to sign up to see if I would be a match. And in that, while I waited, I started researching kidney donation. I realized it was actually kind of an easy thing to do. And there are so many people in need. And the process was just so intriguing to me. So I signed up, and eventually I got an email back from the organization saying, this child doesn't need a kidney anymore. She got one from someone else. But would you still be willing to donate? And I was just totally committed already to the whole process. So I was like, sure, of course I will.
Wow. So in terms of match, I mean, is it like bone marrow? I mean, is it very specific, or is it more just blood type, or what?
It's gotten very specific because they've done so much research and have so much experience now in trying to match people and what actually makes someone a match. So there's a great deal of blood work that's done. I don't know the science behind it, but they do use this computer software program that's really sophisticated, and they can match people that way.
Yeah. So do you know who received your kidney?
I do not. I can find out eventually, possibly, if both of us agree. So I've agreed to find out who I donated to. I haven't heard back from the donee, but it's still relatively early. What I do know is my kidney flew to Madison, Wisconsin. So I know the person's in Wisconsin, and he or she's 50 to 60 years old. That's all I know. But one of the good things about donating to a stranger is I was able to start a kidney chain. So there was actually 8 surgeries involved, and 4 people got kidneys. And so what they do now, because there's so many people who need kidneys, and they may have a family member or a relative or a friend who's willing to donate to them, but they're not a match. So what they do is they do these paired exchanges where they'll I donated to this person in Wisconsin, and then that person who received my kidney has a friend who's willing to donate. And so they donate to someone else they match. So my kidney went to Wisconsin. The Wisconsin kidney went to California. Then the friend of the person receiving in California donated a kidney. They were matched with someone in D.C., so that kidney flew to D.C., and then the D.C. kidney went to Maine. And so there are 4 people got kidneys. So it was just pretty amazing that my donation impacted that many people.
Yeah. So did this cost you anything?
All the medical testing and procedures are all paid for actually by the donee's insurance. I had to pay for my lodging and my transportation, but there's organizations that actually give you grants to reimburse you for that. And there are also ways you can get reimbursed for lost wages and other expenses. So it actually cost me very little because I got reimbursed for my expenses.
Yeah. How long were you out of work?
Well, actually, I'm a mountain host at PCMR, so I wasn't working at the time. I actually arranged so I could donate after the ski season was over. And they're really flexible. You know, they love donors, and so they work with you and your schedule. And, you know, it was just it really wasn't an inconvenience for me.
Yeah. So you did write a letter to the donee. What did you tell him or her?
You know, in the end, really, I felt, even though I was giving this gift, I felt like I got more out of it than this person did. It was just such an empowering experience. And I tried to share that with this person. You know, with the state of the world, you can get kind of depressed and down about all the divisiveness. And you just feel like you don't have power to change the world. And I came across this saying that, you know, if you can't, you might not be able to change the world, but you might be able to change one person's world. And it just made me feel good, like I can make a difference. And, you know, the whole experience was so good. The community rallied around me. My mountain host, they actually threw a party for me. They had they had a bon voyage party for my kidney at the Grand Summit. And, I mean, it was just a great experience. So in the end, I just wanted to thank this person for allowing me to give him this gift. You know, it's such a good experience for me.
Yeah. But no word on how this person is doing health-wise, huh?
You know, they, I know my kidney was sent, my surgery was really early in the morning, and it was flown by, for me, I think United Airlines, flew it to Chicago, and then it was delivered up to Madison. And I heard by the time their surgery was done, it was after midnight, and I heard from the doctor that the kidney started working right away. And so what's amazing about it, when someone receives a kidney, they transform almost immediately, because even on dialysis, dialysis doesn't really clean the blood well enough. So they're just never really normal until they get this kidney, and then they get their color back and they feel great, and they apparently bounce back right away from this. So I heard that the kidney started working and they were feeling much better. And then about a week or two later, I heard that it was still working. It was great. And that's the last I heard, but I'm assuming everything's going really well.
Yeah. And have you noticed any changes?
Not really. You know, I was tired for the first couple of weeks. But, you know, it was a month after surgery, I went, well, both my kids are in marching band at the high school, so I joined the band and went to Normandy with the group going for that 75th D-Day celebration, and I felt fine on the trip. And I started working out again at Orange Theory yesterday. I had to wait 2 months. So, and I felt fine. You know, just the first couple of weeks, I was fatigued, but I don't even know the difference at this point.
Wow. You lose any weight? As a result, I mean, I don't know. How much does a kidney weigh? A pound?
Maybe a pound.
Well, your heart grew by a pound, so how nice. Anything else you wanted to say about that?
Well, I wrote my story and posted it on this Facebook page called Donor to Donor, and it explained my reasoning for doing this and my whole experience, and I think the thing that struck me the most, it was shared by a lot of people. I had so many comments, received so much love. But there were all these people who shared it who needed a kidney for themselves or a family member, a child or spouse, and they wrote, "We're still waiting for our hero."
Yeah, how nice. Mm-hmm. We'll put that link to the story on our website
people
can have
a
look. Again, thank you for your time and for your donation, Laura.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
That's Laura Diaz-Moore. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.